is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. And if it's Scott Braddock, it's the editor of the Quorum Report, also known as the Voice of Texas, also known as the Dean of the Austin Press Corps. So joining us on this Thursday morning where we tape for Friday, just because I want people to understand that something happens on Thursday night, we're not going to know about it.
Right.
I got to ask a question.
By the way, Arnie, things happen so quickly now because the president may be tweeting while we're talking. Who knows? Anytime I'm speaking to a business group or local Republican club or whatever, anytime I'm giving a speech, I always say I'm constantly looking at my phone. I'm not being rude. I'm just making sure that the president didn't tweet something that changes everything I'm about to say.
So it
doesn't really even matter. Everything is dated.
Everything
is old. There's no shelf life for analysis anymore.
That's a brilliant line. There's no shelf life for analysis
anymore. It may be brilliant, but it's my way of just getting out of being wrong if I am.
All right, so let me just say something. So you sent me a list of topics for today, but I got to ask something because something seems kind of interesting to me. Here we go. You begin this way. President Trump will be in Dallas in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Will Texas Republicans avoid the event? Aha.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Your second topic, it sounds like avoidance was actually baked in. That same day, Texas House Republicans are set to convene in Austin for their caucus meeting, which could set the course for the embattled Speaker Dennis Bonin's future. Now, I'm just wondering, did they know the day that Trump would be in Dallas and then plan the meeting in Austin? I just thought, how convenient. We're sorry, Mr. President, we can't be there. We're in Austin.
Which came first here? I do have the answer. The caucus retreat was long planned for months and months that they were going to be. In Austin, all of the more than 80 Republican members of the Texas House convening for their annual caucus retreat. It's a tradition they've done for several years. You know, they get together and play golf and drink and have dinner and talk with each other about what's going on.
Wow.
And it's a time for them to, just basically shoot the breeze and talk about whether there are any issues in front of them that are important for the state while they're not in a legislative session, so that's important for them to get together. Democrats do, something similar as well. But it is interesting. Yeah, the president announced just this week, the White House announced that he will be in Dallas for one of his Make America, great rallies. Again, I guess we're already great, so we need to keep it great or whatever. I lose track, Arnie. But there will be a rally at American Airlines Center in Dallas on October 17th. That's the first day of the caucus retreat. And, talking to folks in Austin, here's the question. Which would you rather really not be at? If you are a Republican Texas House member from DFW, where it might just be a given, the Republican president's coming in, you're a Republican member of the House, you should be there, right? You should be in the front row. You should be on the TV shots and national news. Hey, there's the guy from Collin County. There's the guy from Denton County, et cetera. I think they may be in run and hide mode on that, at least some of them, because as you know, the Texas suburbs, particularly around DFW and Houston, are where the election results were very, very different in 2018. There are, I had the numbers in front of me, there are seven Texas House members who are Republicans who won their seats last year by roughly 3 points or less, and three or four of those won their seats by less than 3 points, so 2.5 points, something like that. There was one Republican House member from Houston who won his seat by a 47-vote margin.
Wow.
Okay, and he announced this week that he's retiring, so he doesn't have to worry about any of this. Probably no chance that he can hold that seat. By the way, that's the guy who wrote and pushed and passed the Merry Christmas bill. This is the one where Texas students are for sure guaranteed they can say Merry Christmas in schools, even though that was already the case. Social conservative stuff. But anyway, look at the conundrum, Arnie. You have the president coming in. You need to show solidarity. Certainly you will have Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick there, probably emceeing the thing. He's Trump's man in Texas. He likes to say that. But I think the fortunes of the statewide Republicans, who are largely not on the ballot next year, are now delinked from those who are down ballot. In those places like Collin County and Denton County, the Republicans would probably be wise to distance themselves from President Trump. But the nuance that Republicans have tried to put forth, this year, the first half of the year was a legislative session. We talked about it many times. What were they focused on? Not on the red meat, social, conservative issues.
Exactly.
Or even,
property taxes.
They were focused on property taxes, school finance, meat and potatoes issues. That's what the former speaker, Joe Strauss, used to call those things. You know, there's the meat and potatoes of government. You know, mm-hmm. just do your job, basically, mm-hmm. And try not to rock the boat. Don't do the things that make people angry. They did a pretty good job with that. Now what do we have? We have two shootings in Texas back-to-back, mass shootings. We have the president who's coming to town who is facing impeachment. The timing of this, all very interesting. I mean, they really hit the gas toward impeachment in Washington.
God.
Right? I mean, we could be talking about a vote on impeachment, you know, maybe by Thanksgiving. I mean, it seems to be moving that quick. Who knows? No predictions, of course. But the president now doubling down on everything that he's saying about Joe Biden. Saw that he put out the television ad yesterday where he basically just admits to everything that's in, you know, the accusations and says, look, Biden's worse because of this scandal. And I know people have opinions about that. But I do think what's going on here, Arnie, for Republicans in Texas, they've got nowhere to hide. I mean, the first 6 months were kind of about giving them some shields, right? You know,
right.
for their primaries and for their general elections next year. Republicans in this state desperately want to hold on to the majority in the Texas House. And we should underscore for people, Democrats only need to pick up 9 seats in the Texas House to take the majority.
Wow.
With that retirement
that
I mentioned,
incredible.
We're probably down to 8. I don't think that the Republicans are going to hold that seat. And I can argue my way all the way to Democrats picking up as many as 12 seats in the state. So the Republican governor, lieutenant governor, and the speaker all have that in mind, while the president just completely denies them nuance. Everything's black and white. You're either with Trump or against Trump. And I think, you know, for Republican voters, especially, Democrats too, I'm sure it's kind of the same. Are you with Trump or not? I mean, I'm hearing about campaigns that some Texas Democrats may run at the state level featuring the question about impeachment. I mean, if you had the election today, the two top issues would be what? Impeachment and guns.
Yeah.
Right. And so you see that on display in Washington. They're talking impeachment. I think all or most of the Democratic candidates just this week were in Las Vegas for that forum MSNBC held about guns. And
right.
So out in the country, they're talking about guns. In Washington, it's impeachment and the president coming to Texas. The other thing we should say about his trip here is this will be his 12th trip to Texas as president.
Wow.
And, you know, at the same time for Obama, I think Obama had a total of 4 trips to Texas, something like that, in his first term. I'd have to go back and make sure. But I do think that Trump's team is taking the idea that Texas is in play very seriously. The candidates on the Democratic side have been here a lot, particularly mm-hmm. in Harris County, where Houston is, where I am this morning, and in Dallas County, which is pretty rich with African-American Democratic votes in Dallas County. And so neither side taking the state for granted. We're not just the ATM for the major political parties anymore. It used to be that we'd only have fundraisers here, and that's the only time we'd see these folks, Arnie. But they're actually campaigning here, and it's getting interesting down in Texas.
So let's get to the nuance of Texas. So we know that Ted Cruz is not he's almost embraced the idea of an investigation for this
mm-hmm.
impeachment.
Well, sort of. Mm-hmm.
So, well, sort of. But he's also announced for 2024, not really, but he's sort
yeah.
of implied that he's available, which also could be implied that, you know, in case you need me in 2020, I'm here too. And then you have Senator Cornyn. So what do the Cruz-Cornyn boys do when Trump comes to Texas? How do they thread that needle? Cornyn's not exactly, you know, the sharpest knife in the drawer, and he's got a lot of issues, and he's got to be somewhat concerned about his race for the U.S. Senate. And Cruz has already sort of let people know that he, you know, is willing to at least consider an investigation into the behavior of the president. Do they show up or do they just say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm busy in Washington?
I think that Cornyn will be there. Seems that his campaign strategy so far is to be buddied up to Trump as much as he can. Remember, the dynamic in Texas is now that we did have straight ticket voting. You know, you could hit the one button and it would give you all the Republican candidates on the ballot, or you could hit the button for all the Democrats and just leave the voting booth. You can't do that anymore in Texas starting next year. So you'll have to hit, you know, the president. Then the next vote down is the U.S. Senate and on down the line. And I think Cornyn has made the calculation, at least from everything we're seeing so far, that Trump is going to carry Texas, even if it's a narrow victory. Remember, Trump in 2016 had the smallest lead for a Republican in decades in this state. He beat Clinton in Texas by 9 points. If you go back to previous presidential cycles, you're talking more like 15, 16 points for the Republican winning Texas.
So it was already soft.
So it was within a 10-point race. Yeah. It was actually a race, you know, even though he did win handily here. But if he let's say he wins by only 7 points, or he wins by 5 points, or let's say he barely wins Texas, you know, with 52 or 53, Cornyn is making the calculation that he's going to try to carry the state by the same amount. Look at all of his rhetoric this past week. Cornyn took to the Senate floor and talked about how Nancy Pelosi was completely out of line, that the Democrats in the House are acting prematurely, that they don't know enough to be moving forward with this impeachment investigation, this inquiry. At the same time, he did admit to reporters on a call, Cornyn did, that you know, there are some things in that conversation between the president and the president of Ukraine. There's some things in there that are troubling, but he didn't think it rose to the level of impeachment. And Cornyn also started to say, and I think this tells you where these campaigns are really going to go, and probably not just for him, but for senators and you know, lawmakers from who are in Washington all across the country and a lot of, you know, back in their home states and home districts. Cornyn started to say, you know, the business of governing in Washington is probably over until this impeachment thing is over, which could drag out, of course, into the middle of next year. So everything that they've done, you know, up to this point, Arnie, is everything they're going to do. So we might as well, you know, move ahead with the election now, because people have all the information they're going to have.
Okay, so except for tax cuts and maybe a little bit of criminal justice reform.
The tax cuts, that's what they got. Yeah,
that's
if
all
you
they
like
got.
That,
they,
that's what you got. And so they're going to have to run on that. Nothing else is going to happen. And you know, think about the absurdity of the statement. They've been getting so much done in Washington, Arnie. Remember, they were just about ready to pass, you know, significant gun legislation, significant immigration legislation. They were getting ready to reform the tax code in a fair way, all these sorts of things. They were just on the cusp of doing that, and if not for the pesky Democrats, they could get it done. But instead, they're obsessed with impeachment.
Well, has anyone asked Cornyn up? Because I saw an article at, I believe it was Slate.com, and here's the title: The Party of Collusion. Trump asked a foreign government for help in an election. Republicans say that's fine. And I guess, has anyone actually asked Cornyn directly, is it fine that you reach out to foreign governments to basically, you know, shake them down for information about your opponents? Has anyone actually had a pointed question to him, and has he had to answer? I mean, this is before the investigation, just a generic, you know, here's an idea. What do you think of this idea? A good idea or a bad idea? Has anyone actually put that question to him?
I don't know that it's been put that in
directly,
that sharp a way,
yes,
to Cornyn, but again, his comment was that there was, you know, there's some troubling conversation there.
Unbelievable, unbelievable. So
yeah.
Let's
well, I would agree it's troubling.
It is.
It is quite a problem. Quite a problem, by the way, Arnie, to be you know, on the phone with the guy who's trying to hold off the evil empire that has tanks rolling into his country. And the United States had already pledged, and Congress had already voted in bipartisan fashion, to give them millions of dollars in military aid to try to contain the Soviet Union.
I know.
Right? We should underscore this. Like, you know, so China is getting a foothold. China, the way the president says it, China getting a foothold in establishing trade with Mexico, just to our south here in Texas. You know, that's our number one trading partner. And, of course, President Trump has been very hostile to Mexico in multiple ways, including on the immigration front, which is what I'm in Houston to talk about today. But you have that going on in Mexico. In the meantime, and China, you know, establishing relationships not just with Mexico, but in Africa, doing all this investment of infrastructure there and everything. You've read about that, of course. But it's Putin's dream to revive the Soviet Union. What, I mean, what do people think that the invasion, the annexation of Crimea was all about? That's what they're up to. And the president, to be telling the president of Ukraine, yeah, we'll help you with that, but I need this favor with my election back in the United States, is kind of unbelievable. I mean, it's just taking everything that has been done to try to contain the old Soviet socialist republics. And remember, this is the Republican Party that tells us every day that the Democrats are socialists and communists, right? And here you have the president siding with Putin in an exchange with the president
KGB
of Ukraine. It's unbelievable that would be going on in the year 2019, and that Republicans, the party of Ronald Reagan, who said, tear down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev, that they'd be okay with that, is unbelievable. And you have, you know, former Senator Jeff Flake saying that if you held the vote in the Senate today, and it was a private vote. Yeah. It was a secret ballot.
35 Republicans,
yeah. I think he said 35 would vote to remove the president. Of course, it is not a secret vote. Right. They are afraid of their primary voters. But it is interesting, if you look at the polling on impeachment, this is what happens when you lead, Arnie. When the Democrats finally say, okay, we're going to go ahead and do this, the numbers on impeachment have started to swing. It was that most people were against it, and you see the poll numbers starting to even out, where it's about half and half, half saying that they're for it and half saying that they're not. The thing about leading, Arnie, and I wish I had come up with this, but the thing about leading is that at first it looks like you're walking by yourself.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And so the Democrats have gotten out ahead of this now, and we'll see where it all goes. But it seems like the attitudes are shifting about this, and they may be shifting in Texas, too. I can tell you that out in real Texas, I was on the road from Austin to Houston yesterday, stopping in some small towns, actually in the small community where Rick Perry now lives most of the time, Round Top, Texas, and mm-hmm. places like that, little bitty communities. They're not talking about impeachment, but they're talking about what are the people in Washington doing to improve our lives. It doesn't seem like a whole lot, mm-hmm. At least for right now. And so when Cornyn goes and says, they're not going to be doing anything in the meantime, it's probably dispiriting to people. And I think in an overall sense, that would contribute to what the most important poll number is, which is, and this was a poll number that was exactly correct leading up to the 2016 election. People like to say that the polls were wrong, but they weren't. Remember, the right track, wrong track number is the most important number when they're picking a president. Right. If the country is on the right track, then you're going to stick with the party that's in the White House. And if it's on the wrong track, you're going to do the opposite, right? The wrong track numbers were huge leading into 2016. Even though Clinton won the popular vote, the people went the other way. They wanted to see some sort of a change. If people are wondering, what are they really doing in Washington to improve anybody's lives, that can't be good for the occupant of the Oval Office.
Well, and not only that, but I think this is the other thing that sort of makes me frustrated with the Democratic Party, and that is that Nancy Pelosi's House has passed probably 200, 250 bills. They've sent those bills over to where? To the Senate. And where are they? They're dying on Mitch McConnell's desk. And what I wish they would do is, because people keep saying, you're doing nothing. No. The Senate is doing nothing. The Senate is not holding hearings. The Senate is not taking things up. And what I've been desperate for the Democrats to do from the House is, you remember the Excedrin headache 101, Excedrin headache 95? They need to start doing, these are the bills we have passed. This is where they've died. These are the bills we've passed. And just start listing them by numbers
that.
And let people
mm-hmm.
know that. Because the idea is all they're focused on is impeachment. That is not true. The problem is that you need two bodies to pass it, so it gets to the president's desk. Nothing really gets to the president's desk. And then they just did some economic analysis that said 70% of Americans have not felt anything from the tax cuts. 70% of Americans have not felt any real benefit from the economy. You can also start playing that out. For the 30% that are doing well, mazel tov to you. But guess what? 70% of Americans have not benefited from this. So I think that's the kind of combination that you have moving forward. And the other thing is, you said you're going to be talking about immigration. So one of my producers over here just handed me something. Is Donald Trump coming to Texas because he's looking for alligators? I mean, the idea that he wants to have moats, the idea that he wants to shoot people in the legs, the man sounds like he's coming from feudal times. This is the medieval castle. I keep wanting Monty Python to write about Donald Trump because it's totally appropriate. This is like their version of the Holy Grail. It's scary in a lot of ways because even the language and the suggestions that he makes, they're not only inhumane, they're so ancient in their evilness.
The president had said that he thought there should be snakes and alligators in the Rio Grande,
right.
Or there should be a moat.
With
snakes. There are already snakes in the Rio Grande, I can tell you that. Not snakes in the water is just ignorant. The comment that the president made about shooting people in the legs, he said that would slow them down and that would deter other people from coming in. And the folk, according to the reporting, the aides in the meeting would sit there sort of slack-jawed. They don't know if the guy is kidding about that or if he's serious. But does it really matter?
Yeah.
Who says that?
I know. Who thinks that? Not even who says that. I mean, there are a lot of people that think things and don't say them. Understand?
Yeah. There's some of us have a filter, though. I mean, we might think it, and then
I know,
you don't actually go through with, letting the even having it go from your brain to your mouth. and out to everybody else.
It's shocking. So we got to talk a little bit about 2020. We know that Bernie has just pulled his ads from Iowa. He had a huge buy. We know he brought in about $25 million. We also know that he had something wrong with his heart. People are saying, is it a heart attack? What are these stents? Mm-hmm. Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
That just makes me think, okay, let's just say as a possibility that Bernie does not continue to run. Let's just put this as a possibility.
I think it's very possible based on what we're hearing.
Mm-hmm. So who will benefit from that? Who will benefit more, Beto or Julian?
That's a good question. It seems like that neither of them, you grade my paper on this, Arnie.
Okay,
it seems like neither of them were taking him on as much as some of the other folks. You had Beto, who's been trying to make the case that, you know, Biden is the past and guys like himself, like O'Rourke, are the future. Castro had gone after Beto. I will say that we are coming down to the wire, and we talked about this on our podcast this week. If people want to tune in, they can for more on that. The Texas Take on iTunes or on Stitcher or however you get your podcasts. I do that with the Houston Chronicle here. I think definitely down to the wire. Look at some of the comments that these guys are making, and I'm not sure who benefits from perhaps Bernie not being there. I think the obvious answer is just Warren. Right, because they've been, you know, they kind of share a lot of the same voters.
Yep.
Maybe I think you would know more about it than I would.
Yep.
But I do think that when you look at the fundraising appeals, you have Beto just outright making fun of the way some of these folks are raising money. He had in an email this week that, and I think he said this out loud somewhere too at an event, that he could, you know, conceivably do a Facebook Live video with a kitten and sort of threaten the kitten, like, now you don't want anything to happen to this kitten, right? Send me $5, that sort of thing. And Miss Fluffy will be okay. He's just making fun of the fact that the fundraising appeals are so ridiculous. But you've got Castro, who's sort of making similar appeals about, if I don't raise a certain amount of money. Beto almost saying, if I don't raise a certain amount of money,
I
won't be able to continue with this, sort of like what Cory Booker said. What was the amount that he put out there? If I don't raise $1.7 million or something like that, that I'll have to drop out of this thing. We've got another debate coming up very quickly. I mean, John Delaney is still running for president, but who knows it? I think Beto's saying that he's probably okay fundraising-wise through Iowa.
Yeah,
but not much after that.
Castro? Castro, that's my question.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's going to the extent of saying that there is no chance that he would come back and run for U.S. Senate if given that choice of his or basically facing no other choice on anything to run for if his White House bid flames out. I think they kind of have to say that, Arnie. And how many times have you seen where somebody says they'll never run for this other thing, but then, of course, they do? And the answer is always, well, people are asking me to run for that.
Yeah.
Polling has indicated that most Texas Democrats, or at least a significant number of Texas Democrats, I don't have it in front of me, but a lot of Democrats in this state want Beto to drop out and run against Cornyn. And you have at least five Democrats who have already lined up for the primary,
mm-hmm.
Including a state senator from Dallas, a councilwoman from Houston, a former congressman, the congressional candidate M.J. Hager, who a lot of people were excited about last year, just yesterday, another councilman from Midland, Texas, citing the mass shooting they had in Midland, Odessa, as the reason what inspired him to get into this race. So I think it's going to be pretty wide open on the Democratic side. I don't think that just because Beto or Castro might come back and run for Senate that all of a sudden those candidates would just clear the field and drop out of the race. I don't think that's going to happen. I think
mm-hmm.
a lot of them are really putting their sweat equity into it right now.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see. And the difference, obviously, between Castro and O'Rourke in a statewide race is that O'Rourke is battle-tested in a statewide race here, and Castro is not. And I think Castro is not as well-known outside of San Antonio, where he was mayor, nearly as Beto was, who became sort of a national figure with his race against Senator Cruz.
All right, real quickly, you mentioned that Elizabeth Warren's campaign is ramping up in Texas, and you
mm-hmm.
thought that doesn't matter. I actually think it does matter. I think she does see the potential for it going purple or even potentially blue. I think she's sort of looking – she plays the long game all the time. She is the turtle.
Mm-hmm.
And now with obviously the issue about Bernie, we don't know what that means. I think she wants to be the heir apparent for sure. So I think think it makes a lot of sense for her to sort of display her skill set. Plus, this is a state that has a large Hispanic population. She also, wants to reinforce her relationship there. You know, that's one of the big issues. What will happen with the Black community for a lot of these candidates? What will happen with the Hispanic community for a lot of these candidates? So if you're going to, you know, go to South Carolina, obviously you're going to appeal to the Black voters for the primary. But if you go to Texas, think about who you're getting to appeal to. I think she's really smart to do that.
She also has Texas ties, of course. She went to the University of Houston, she likes to say, back when it was just a commuter school. She was a practicing attorney here and a few other things. Of course, she is from Oklahoma. Well, right. Oklahoma, the only state in the nation that had the wisdom where every single county thought that it was a good idea to have Sarah Palin be one heartbeat away from the presidency. I would say that the other
thing
about
factoid.
the other thing about Warren's the reporting on her campaign in Texas is that she's moving to support state level candidates, particularly Texas House candidates who are Democrats. And I think that and I don't know how much time we have, Arnie. Cut me off if you need to, but I could probably say this in 30 seconds.
All right, real quick.
The energy in Texas in 2018 was sort of top down with this Beto O'Rourke phenomenon, raising so much money and getting people all amped up with the Senate race. There are six congressional races in Texas targeted by the DCCC this year, and there's going to be serious money and help for Texas House Democrats. So I think the energy in 2020 may come from both directions, of people who are angry with President Trump at the top, and a lot of this organizing that's happening in the congressional and state
and
house races
that,
from the bottom up.
And on that comment, we're going to say goodbye to Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He's also known as the Voice of Texas. If it's Friday, it must be Scott. Have fun today with your immigration talk. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk
to
you.
All right, everyone, stick around. We're talking teachers and education, a subject dear to my heart. We'll be right back.
Stormwater and sewage on this current cast. In many parts of Pittsburgh, stormwater and sewage are carried in the same pipes. So during heavy rain, the system can overflow and dump untreated sewage directly into the city's rivers.
As we get more and more rain, it just is an outdated way of managing the flow of stormwater, and it's just disgusting.
That's Stefan Bontrager of the nonprofit Riverlife. He says to better protect the rivers and people's health, the city is working to upgrade its aging infrastructure. Pittsburgh is also partnering with nonprofits and landowners to restore watersheds and plant rain gardens.
So that you can capture a lot of that storm water before it ever even hits the sewer system.
Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
Who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. Your elders grew wise, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die.
Teach
parents well. Their children's hell will slowly go by and feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. So I'm getting my email, and I see an email from John Morrow, and it's about teachers. And actually, the lead is teaching a calling, a profession, or just another job? I've known John for way too long. He is now a retired human being. Lucky you, John Morrow. But before that, he was incredibly involved with public television and so many other organizations, working on the whole sort of discussion of education and public education in America. And if you want someone with a level of expertise, there isn't someone that doesn't rise to the top the way John does. So let me welcome John to the program. And John, real quickly, give us a sort of a short synopsis of like who you are, who you were, and why education is such a passion for you.
Oh, well, thank you very much for those kind words, Arnie. It's nice to be back with you again. I'm retired. I spend as much time as I can on my bike, but I did spend, I guess, 40-plus years as either a high school teacher, mostly as a correspondent covering public education for the PBS NewsHour or NPR, I guess about 41 years. But I also taught in high school for 2 years, at a public black college for 2 years, and in a federal prison for 2 years.
Wow.
So I spent a lot of time either in front of it, most of the time in the back of the room, which is why I appreciate teachers so much. I mean, teaching is an astounding job, work, profession, whatever you want to call it. The piece you referred to, Arnie, I raised the question whether it's a profession, because I ran into some anti-union guy who was basically ragging, going after teachers. And it just made me wonder, can you call it a profession when there's so much hostility? And then the working conditions are certainly less than ideal.
Yeah,
teachers can't take a bathroom break when they need one. And can you call it a profession if you can't go use the bathroom? Yeah. So anyway, it just.
I'll start with a little bit of sort of a background on me. I am the daughter of two school teachers. My father was a teacher of the year in New York City. An amazing man. But I think I've told you this story before, John. I'm 17 years old. We're flying off, my papa and myself, to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. And as we're on the airplane, we're talking about my future. What will I be when I grow up? And here's my father, one of the most amazing teachers you could ever possibly meet. And my father looks at me, and this, everyone, is 1971. Okay, I want people to go back that far. And he says to me, whatever you do, don't become a teacher. And I looked at my dad, and I was heartbroken. I mean, seriously, I was heartbroken because I thought the sun rose and set on my father, and he was such a phenomenal teacher. And why would he not want me to enter his profession? But it was because he thought people didn't perceive it as a profession because he thought it was really being – it was being challenged as something of value. And when he first entered the teaching profession, especially in New York and New York City, that was not the case. It was one of the most competitive jobs. It was something that people really respected, that you wanted to be a teacher, especially in New York City. But what he had seen over the course of decades was an erosion of that value and understanding
and
of that.
Yes, and it's continued. And that was years ago, and it's continued, unfortunately.
Right. And you put in your piece – I thought this was so interesting. You write, you know, is it a teaching, is teaching a calling, a profession, or just another job? And then you write, so are they quitting because they're fed up with their heavy-handed union bosses? The hostility of the question took me by surprise. I was explaining to my dinner companion, a veteran lawyer, that 40% of teachers workers leave the field within 5 years. And right away, he jumped to his anti-union conclusion. Yeah. You and I both know why they're leaving, and unions have virtually nothing to do with it.
Virtually nothing to do with it. No, I mean, it's arguably the most important work a human being can do. I mean, it's a helping profession. It attracts terrific people. And yet there's this hostility, this anti-union. Some of it stems from kind of an American selfishness, that we don't see other people's children as part of our future. As I say, we lose a lot of people. But, you know, among the myths, I mean, the American myth is that, well, teachers come from the bottom of the society. Well, that's just demonstrably false. Only half of Americans graduate from college, and you have to graduate from college to teach. So therefore, teachers come from the top half.
Right.
Not even half graduate from college. And in fact, if you look at the data, a lot of teachers come from terrific schools. They are motivated to do something to help other people, mm-hmm. and we don't reward that.
No.
Teachers have lost, actually, their salaries have gone down, adjusted for inflation over the last 10 years. And now what's happened, it used to be that we're driving people out. Now people are not going in.
Yes.
So, I mean, this is a real crisis.
Let me share a story with you, and I've shared it before on the radio. So my daughter teaches in Shanghai, and she's an ESL teacher, but she teaches a lot of younger children. So she said, oh, Mom, there's an elementary school across the street from where you live. I think I want to shadow the elementary school teachers in your town. I said, that would be fantastic. She said, maybe I can learn some new skills, and I can share with them what I've learned. Let me tell you what happened. She came home, and she was outraged. She was in tears. She was in tears, in part because of what she saw, which was the struggling of these teachers, okay? She could not believe that they were being asked to teach in a setting. Well, this is one of the better schools in the state. You need to understand this. But mm-hmm. the challenges of the classroom were overwhelming. And let me share something that is the dirty little secret that we have not sort of embraced. You and I both know that we have a huge opioid crisis, especially mm-hmm. in certain states, West Virginia, New Hampshire, Ohio. And it turns out that a lot of the children of parents who were addicted or are dead are now being raised by their grandparents or have come from families that have only known addiction. And those number of children that are now entering elementary school is growing exponentially. So
and that falls on teachers.
Yes, yes. And one of the first or second grade teachers was telling my daughter that she said, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, we might have one or two in our classroom. Now we have 5, 6, and 7 in our classroom. Have they given us extra aids? Do they give us extra support? She said, and these kids are so damn needy. You know, it isn't just about coding. It's about so much more than that. So even if teachers were struggling before, we need to start connecting the dots, because this is the canary in the coal mine, especially at the elementary school level, because if there is a problem with the family, you notice it when they're 5 years old because they show up in school.
You know, Arnie, I agree with you. This is a developing crisis that we can't tinker with this. We can't put Band-Aids on. And I would argue that schools need, well, first of all, we need to throw off this yoke of standardized tests as
yes.
the be-all and end-all. I mean, we've had in the past was a sorting system. The school decided whether you were an A kind of kid or a C kind of kid. And oftentimes, the decision was influenced by your parents' education, your
right.
color of your skin, and so on. But test scores were the way that they would, one way they do it. We need to just throw that off. We need school to look at each kid and not say, how intelligent is this kid? But ask a different question, how is this kid intelligent? Because every child,
yes.
every child has talents.
Yes.
But you then, if you say, okay, if we're going to ask that question, how is Arnie intelligent? How is John intelligent?
Yeah.
Then you say, well, what can we do? Well, let's appeal. Arnie is actually interested in auto mechanics. He wants to grow up and repair cars. Well, let's use that interest to make sure she learns to write, work with numbers, and so on. But you can't do that if a classroom has 35 kids.
Yes.
You just can't do that. So you have to say, do we care enough about children to invest carefully, thoughtfully? And in fact, you might not even have to spend too much more money. You should spend more money, but you can't just throw money at it. You have to say, we need to make a fundamental change and ask a different question. How is this child intelligent? And then figure out, how do we build on that kid's strengths? And there are schools that are doing it. And there's project-based learning where kids work together on something they care about. And that means teachers are not standing in front of the room doing all the talking. Teachers are doing a lot more guiding. And that makes teaching a better job. I mean, there are ways. I wrote a book about it. I'm going to give a little plug for a book called Addicted to Reform, a 12-step program to rescue public education. Because I do lay out what I think we can do and what some schools are doing.
Well, you know, you mentioned the testing. So I just want folks to understand, if you go into the best private schools in America, and I mean even starting at the elementary school level, ask how many tests they're taking. No. See, this is what I want to know. I want to know what they're doing at Phillips Exeter. I want to know what they're doing at Choate. I want to know what they're doing. And if you go into both the high schools and the middle schools at these private elite schools, including elementary, you will find out what is flourishing. Art, music, instruments, dance. What is not flourishing are testing. They don't spend the time testing. Oh, my God.
And you know, Arnie, the way to push this is, you know, right now, speaking of testing, we value what we measure. We need to turn that around. Let's measure what we value. Do you care about art and music?
Yeah.
Okay, if you as a parent or you as a citizen care about it, you have to insist on a measurement of art and music. How many hours of art and music do students have every week?
Yeah.
See, we don't ask that question. Now, if you ask that question, that says we care about it.
Right.
And if the answer is zero, then if educators are smart, they're going to know that zero is a bad answer. How many hours of recess? Recess matters. Kids should play.
Yeah.
But if you don't measure that, it ain't going to happen. So parents and citizens have to say to educators, we want these measures. We don't just care about test scores. We want to know how many hours of recess every week, how many hours of art and music.
We want to know
what the rate of teacher turnover is.
Oh, my God.
Because a high rate of teacher turnover is a bad sign.
It's a very bad. So, John, you were talking about recess, and I think you may have heard me tell this story. So there was a family from Norway that went to Texas for a couple of years because he was working for a big company down there. And he had young children. My daughter happened to be an au pair for them when they were back in Norway. And he said to me, I will never go back to the States. How the hell do you educate your kids? I said, excuse me? Listen to what he said. He said, you expect children, young children, to sit in their seats and be doodling. Beautiful and attentive from 8 o'clock in the morning till 2:30 in the afternoon. He said, you know what we do in Norway? For every hour you spend in the classroom, you spend 15 minutes outside. We don't put our kids on Ritalin. We don't put our kids on drugs. We don't expect our kids to sit there and just be almost dull in the room. We expect them to be children. We see the value of recess. Your point about recess, you make me smile. People don't understand. You don't need a gym per se, but you do need recess. Says kids do need to move. They do
and
need to move.
Yeah, around. Unstructured.
Unstructured.
Again,
totally.
Arnie, it will not happen unless we measure it.
Yes.
Because we're a measurement mad society. So anybody listening to this, if you care about the health of kids, demand to know how many hours of recess the kids have every week. How many hours every week?
Because
educators are smart. They're going to know that one is not a good answer. And seven is a much better answer.
But you know,
you have to make your values manifest.
But they have to understand that it's valuable. They have to understand that asking about art is valuable, not just because your kid is not going to necessarily be a Picasso, but there are so many other skill sets that come as a result of that. That they may not be, you know, a phenomenal violinist, but they may end up becoming a great math student because they show the connection between music and math. And when you begin to look at these things. My daughter was dyslexic. Do you know how come she learned to read? Because she had theater. She wanted to perform on a stage when she was in fourth grade. And she saw other kids perform, but they could read the script and she could not. So the door that opened to reading wasn't that somebody was saying, oh, you're dyslexic, you have to learn to read. It was that she wanted to learn to perform. We are dying on the vine with our kids. And what's so ironic is we know things that work. They keep talking about Finland, for example. And there was a wonderful article called Finish the Job, talking about looking at education. What is it, John, that makes Finland such a remarkable place? What are they doing? They keep saying, oh, it's homogeneous, oh, yada, yada. But there's got to be something that they must be doing right that we could also embrace. I don't mind copying something. I just want to make sure that what I copy actually will have a positive effect.
Well, we should be copying things that work. And there's a book called Finnish Lessons, F-I-N-N-I-S-H, by Pasi Sahlberg. And that does lay out some of that. But a lot of it has to do with attitudes toward kids. Now, regarding your daughter, if she had been in a school which asked, how is she intelligent, a teacher would have picked up on that interest in theatrics, and they would have opened that door. It wouldn't have just required her determination and I'm sure her parents' involvement as well. I mean, it could have been the school working with the parents and the kid to get her there sooner so that she doesn't have to perceive that she has a weakness. Rather, instead, she has this strength. This is doable. I mean, I don't want people listening to this to think it's all gloom and doom. We have to make our values manifest. What do we care about? Now, you have to. The one thing I would just say is that, I had a near death experience a couple of years ago. I had a sepsis infection and went into shock and convulsions. BP, blood pressure dropped to the organ threatening level, and they intervened and saved my life. And when I came to, I have this vivid picture in my head. There were about 15 people, some most hovering over me, but in the room. Now, I'm a white male. Of those 15 people, I think there were three who looked like me. The others, there were a lot of women. There were men of color, women of color.
Right.
What I draw from that is, look, we better educate all our children. Because if you're a white man, you better educate all those kids. Because some of them are going to be monitoring your heart rate.
Right.
Some of them are going to be tuning up the jet engines on the plane you're getting on with your grandchildren.
Right.
Some of them will be fixing the gas leak at your neighbor's house. You want them to be competent.
Right.
You can't just say, oh, I'll live behind in this gated community and just care about my children and grandchildren. That doesn't work.
Well,
you can't build a wall.
And you mentioned the 15 people when you came to. So you know what comes into my head? That in medicine, they perceive it as a team sport.
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit about education. Because as my father said, it was a very lonely profession.
Yes.
And I don't think people quite comprehend what he meant. Explain to my audience why we need to look at it as more of a team sport and not as the solo performer in front of a classroom.
Yeah, and that's that myth of the super teacher who changes lives. And sure, there are some people are better teachers than others, but you can't, if you create that myth, you're also creating a way of blaming teachers when kids fail. If you conceive of education as a team sport, well, the first thing you have to do, again, you have to measure what you value. So the unit of measurement in education should not be the kid, the primary unit, should not be the kid, it shouldn't be the teacher, it should be the school.
Right.
Let's figure out a way to evaluate a school and make everyone involved in that school responsible. Give them the so let's say what you care about are graduation rates, ability to speak publicly, to ability to work with others, and you have to have multiple measures.
Right.
But then let's say let's hold the whole school accountable, including the custodians, and when everyone does well, then everyone is rewarded. So that what that means, Arnie, if you and I are teachers, I have a vested interest in your success. You care about my success. Now, that would mean to the principal. The principal would say, well, I want to make sure Arnie and John benefit from each other, learn from each other's mistakes. I better have some time in there so John can go watch Arnie teach.
Right.
See that? So that, to what your dad said about it being a lonely profession, this would mean it's not lonely.
Yeah.
Because you and I are going to work together. There are ways to do these things. But again, you have to make manifest what you care about. But the primary unit of judging should be the school. Obviously, you have to care about how Joe does and how Sylvia does. And you have to worry about individual teachers. But if the unit of measurement is the school, then you're gonna get on my case if I start malingering, because the performance, all of us have to be working together.
Right.
I mean, think about the theater and your daughter in the theater.
Yeah, absolutely.
A performance is a team sport.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's just, and I love the idea that everybody matters. That from the guidance counselor to the janitor, that if they see it as a gestalt, then everyone has ownership of the result. I mean, that's the piece that's so exciting to me.
Can I say one more thing?
Of course.
When you do that, you create an atmosphere in which bullying, for example, is not tolerated. And so you have the leadership of the school, meaning the student leaders. What your goal is to have them say, hey, we don't do that. We don't do that here.
Right.
But you have to model that. And you have to have really high aspirations, and you know you're going to fail. And you have to have a way to talk about failure and what can we do better.
Yeah.
But you have to make manifest what you value.
Yeah.
Whether it's measuring how much recess there is, using the school as a primary unit of judging. You can do these things. That's what matters. And we have to do them, Marty.
Well, you have something else in your wonderful blog post. You wrote, the governance of most schools contradicts the notion that teaching is a team sport. Often it's labor versus management, with teachers punching a time clock twice a day. Teachers are rarely asked to play a role in choosing curriculum, for example. Obviously, pay is a problem. Obviously, you know, being able to sort of re-educate themselves over the course of time because things change and they need to improve. But I do think that we really do see the rot beginning at the top. Look at Betsy DeVos. No knowledge of education. None. And I'm going to go back to something that Cory Booker did. Cory Booker sat down with Zuckerberg, and they were going to fix the schools in his city. Well, you know what? Which one of them was a teacher? Neither one of them was a teacher. I want to know. I think they should have sat down with teachers and said, tell me what's going on. What is it that you need? Instead, they were going to come up with the magic result. This is part of the problem. There is an arrogance on the part of the very wealthy that they know what's wrong with schools. There's an arrogance on the part of politicians that they know what's wrong with schools. If you actually talk to a teacher and talk to a student, you might learn a hell of a lot.
I agree with you. I mean, I think Betsy DeVos is supremely unqualified, in my judgment. And the fact that the Senate approved her, I mean, Lamar Alexander, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, they could have stopped her. They knew she was unqualified.
Right.
But they gave her a pass, and
it's
creating havoc.
She is creating havoc. She is undermining public education and public institutions.
A good thing, though, is her attitudes have, I think, awakened an awful lot of people at the local level.
Yes.
And saying, we need to speak up for public education. We need to get involved in our schools.
Yes.
So part of it that she's unqualified, but she's also incompetent. So she's not doing as much damage as a smart, competent person could do.
Yeah.
But it is an occasion for local communities to say, we want to take charge of our schools. We want to measure what we value. We need to have a conversation about what we value. Do we want our kids just to be good test takers? Do we want them to be able to work with others? Do we want them to be able to get up and speak publicly? Do we want them to be able to perform, play an instrument, take a part in a play? If we want those things, let's talk about doing it. So, there is real light at the end of this tunnel.
At one point, you did an amazing thing. I think it was for PBS, where you followed two teachers. One was teaching in a very wealthy public school. One was teaching in a very poor public school in my state of New Hampshire. What I would love you to do sometime, if you in your spare time during retirement, is I want you to go to some of the fanciest prep schools, and I want people to see what happens there, and then I want them to go into a public school. And if it's really important for the wealthy elite to have education that includes things like art and sports and ballet and this, then guess what? what? If it's good for them, tell me why it's not good for your kid.
Absolutely.
If it makes them leaders, then tell me why it's not good for your kid, because couldn't your kid want to achieve the idea of leadership? That's what a democracy actually encourages. It's not about DNA. It's about ability. That means that ability could come from Roxbury, or that ability could come from one of the finest schools in the most wealthiest communities in the world. So I think also, again, we need to see what they do. So when you demand of your school, and copy it, exactly.
Demand it. Yeah.
John Merle, thank you so much. I need to let you go. What is the title of your blog so that people can find it?
The blog is themerroreport.com, M-E-R-R-O-W.
Okay.
Themerroreport.com. And the book is Addicted to Reform.
Thank you so much for joining us. And in your retirement, keep writing this stuff, all right?
It's a pleasure. Thank you,
all right, Arnie. Take care. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll see you next week. You better think.